What? Rosalie was staring at him. What do you mean?
I mean that all is not the gold that glitters. I mean that all this lady is rich and beautiful and beloved. There is all the same something that is not right.
And I know something else.
Yes?
I know, said Poirot, frowning, that somewhere at some time I have heard that voice before, the voice of Monsieur Doyle, and I wish I could remember where.
But Rosalie was not listening. She had stopped dead. With the point of her sunshade, she was tracing patterns in the loose sand. Suddenly she broke out fiercely.
I'm odious. I'm quite odious. I'm just a beast through and through. I'd like to tear the clothes off her back and stamp on her lovely, arrogant, self-confident face. I'm just a jealous cat. But that's what I feel like. She's so horribly successful and poised and assured.
Hercule Poirot looked a little astonished by the outburst. He took her by the arm and gave her a friendly little shake.
Tenez, you will feel better for having said that.
I just hate her. I've never hated anyone so much at first sight.
Magnificent.
Rosalie looked at him doubtfully. Then her mouth twitched and she laughed.
Bien,
said Poirot, and laughed too. They proceeded amicably back to the hotel.
I must find Mother,
said Rosalie as they came into the cool, dim hall. Poirot passed out on the other side onto the terrace overlooking the Nile. Here were little tables set for tea, but it was early still. He stood for a few moments looking down onto the river, then strolled down through the gardens. Some people were playing tennis in the hot sun. He paused to watch them for a while, then went on down the steep path. It was there, sitting on a bench overlooking the Nile, that he came across the girl of Chematont. He recognized her at once. Her face, as he had seen it that night, was securely etched upon his memory. The expression on it was now very different. She was paler, thinner, and there were lines that told of a great weariness and misery of spirit. He drew back a little. She had not seen him, and he watched her for a while without her suspecting his presence. Her small foot tapped impatiently on the ground. Her eyes, dark, with a kind of smouldering fire, had a queer kind of suffering, dark triumph in them. She was looking out across the Nile where the white-sailed boats glided up and down the river. A face and a voice. He remembered them both. This girl's face and the voice he had heard just now, the voice of a newly made bridegroom. And even as he stood there considering the unconscious girl, the next scene in the drama was played. Voices sounded above. The girl on the seat started to her feet. Lynette Doyle and her husband came down the path. Lynette's voice was happy and confident. The look of strain and tenseness of muscle had quite disappeared. Lynette was happy. The girl who was standing there took a step or two forward. The other two stopped dead.
"Hello, Lynette," said Jacqueline de Belfort. "So here you are. We never seem to stop running into each other. Hello, Simon. How are you?"
Lynette Doyle had shrunk back against the rock with a little cry. Simon Doyle's good-looking face was suddenly convulsed with rage. He moved forward as though he would have liked to strike the slim, girlish figure. With a quick, bird-like turn of her head, she signalled her realization of a stranger's presence. Simon turned his head and noticed Poirot. He said awkwardly,
Hello, Jacqueline.
We didn't expect to see you here. The words were unconvincing in the extreme. The girl flashed white teeth at them.
Quite a surprise, she asked.
Then, with a little nod, she walked up the path. Poirot moved delicately in the opposite direction. As he went, he heard Lynette Doyle say,
Simon, for God's sake, Simon, what can we do?
Chapter 3. Dinner was over. The terrace outside the Cataract Hotel was softly lit. Most of the guests staying at the hotel were there sitting at little tables. Simon and Lynette Doyle came out, a tall, distinguished-looking grey-haired man with a keen, clean-shaven American face beside them. As the little group hesitated for a moment in the doorway, Tim Allerton rose from his chair nearby and came forward.
"You don't remember me, I'm sure," he said pleasantly to Lynette, "but I'm Joanna Southwood's cousin."
"Oh, of course. How stupid of me. You're Tim Allerton. This is my husband."
A faint tremor in the voice. Pride? Shyness?
"'And this is my American trustee, Mr. Pennington.'
Tim said, "'You must meet my mother.' A few minutes later they were sitting together in a party. Lynette in the corner, Tim and Pennington each side of her, both talking to her, vying for her attention. Mrs. Allerton talked to Simon Doyle. The swing doors revolved. A sudden tension came into the beautiful upright figure sitting in the corner between the two men. Then it relaxed as a small man came out and walked across the terrace. Mrs. Allerton said, "'You're not the only celebrity here, my dear. That funny little man is Hercule Poirot.' She had spoken lightly, just out of instinctive social tact to bridge an awkward pause, but Lynette seemed struck by the information.
"'Hercule Poirot?' "'Oh, of course, I've heard of him.'
She seemed to sink into a fit of abstraction. The two men on either side of her were momentarily at a loss. Poirot had strolled across to the edge of the terrace, but his attention was immediately solicited.
"'Sit down, Monsieur Poirot. What a lovely night!'
He obeyed.
"'Mais oui, madame, it is indeed beautiful.'
He smiled politely at Mrs. Otterbourne. What draperies of black ninon, and that ridiculous turban effect! Mrs. Otterbourne went on in her high, complaining voice.
"'Quite a lot of notabilities here now, aren't there? I expect we shall see a paragraph about it in the paper soon. Society beauties, famous novelists.'
She paused with a slight mock, modest laugh. Poirot felt, rather than saw, the sulky, frowning girl opposite him flinch, and set her mouth in a sulkier line than before.
"'You have a novel on the way at present, madame?'
he inquired. Mrs. Otterbourne gave her little self-conscious laugh again.
"'I'm being dreadfully lazy. I really must set to. My public is getting terribly impatient, and my publisher, poor man, appeals by every post, even cables.'
Again he felt the girl shift in the darkness.
"'I don't mind telling you, Monsieur Poirot, I'm partly here for local colour. Snow on the Desert's Face. That's the title of my new book. Powerful. Suggestive. Snow on the Desert. Melted in the first flaming breath of passion.'
Rosalie got up, muttering something, and moved away down into the dark garden.
"'One must be strong,' went on Mrs. Otterbourne, wagging the turban emphatically. "'Strong meat. That is what my books are. Libraries may ban them, no matter. I speak the truth. Sex. Ah, Monsieur Poirot, why is everyone so afraid of sex? The pivot of the universe. You have read my books?'
"'Alas, madame, you comprehend I do not read many novels. My work,'
Mrs. Otterbourne said firmly.
"'I must give you a copy of Under the Fig Tree. I think you will find it significant. It is outspoken, but it is real.'
"'That is most kind of you, madame. I will read it with pleasure.'
Mrs. Otterbourne was silent a minute or two. She fidgeted with a long chain of beads that was wound twice round her neck. She looked swiftly from side to side.
"'Perhaps I'll just slip up and get it for you now.
Oh, madame, pray do not trouble yourself. Later.
No, no, it's no trouble.
She rose.
I'd like to show you.
What is it, mother? Rosalie was suddenly at her side.
Nothing, dear. I was just going up to get a book for Monsieur Poirot.
Oh, the fig tree. I'll get it.
You don't know where it is, dear. I'll go.
Yes, I do.
The girl went swiftly across the terrace and into the hotel.
Let me congratulate you, madame, on a very lovely daughter,
said Poirot with a bow.
"'Rosalie? Yes, yes, she is good-looking. But she's very hard, Monsieur Poirot, and no sympathy with illness. She always thinks she knows best. She imagines she knows more about my health than I do myself.'
Poirot signalled to a passing waiter.
"'A liqueur, madame? A chartreuse? A crème de menthe?'
Mrs. Otterbourne shook her head vigorously.
No, I'm practically a teetotaler. You may have noticed I never drink anything but water, or perhaps lemonade. I cannot bear the taste of spirits.
Then may I order you a lemon squash, madame?
He gave the order. One lemon squash and one Benedictine. The swing door revolved. Rosalie passed through and came towards them, a book in her hand.
Here you are,
she said. Her voice was quite expressionless, almost remarkably so.
"'Monsieur Poirot has just ordered me a lemon squash,' said her mother.
"'And you, mademoiselle, what will you take?'
"'Nothing,'
she added, suddenly conscious of the curtness.
"'Nothing. Thank you.'
Poirot took the volume which Mrs. Otterbourne held out to him. It still bore its original jacket, a gaily coloured affair representing a lady with smartly shingled hair and scarlet fingernails sitting on a tiger skin in the traditional costume of Eve. Above her was a tree with the leaves of an oak, bearing large and improbably coloured apples. It was entitled Under the Fig Tree by Salome Otterborn. On the inside was a publisher's blurb. It spoke enthusiastically of the superb courage and realism of this study of a modern woman's love life. Fearless, unconventional, realistic were the adjectives used. Poirot bowed and murmured,
I am honoured, madame.
As he raised his head, his eyes met those of the authoress's daughter. Almost involuntarily, he made a little movement. He was astonished and grieved at the eloquent pain they revealed. It was at that moment that the drinks arrived and created a welcome diversion. Poirot lifted his glass gallantly.
À votre santé, madame, mademoiselle.
Mrs. Otterborn, sipping her lemonade, murmured,
Oh, so refreshing. Delicious.
Silence fell on the three of them. They looked down to the shining black rocks on the Nile. There was something fantastic about them in the moonlight. They were like vast prehistoric monsters lying half out of the water. A little breeze came up suddenly, and as suddenly, died away. There was a feeling in the air of hush, of expectancy. Hercule Poirot brought his gaze to the terrace and its occupants. Was he wrong, or was there the same hush of expectancy there? It was like a moment on the stage when one is waiting for the entrance of the leading lady. And just at that moment, the swing doors began to revolve once more. This time, it seemed as though they did so with a special air of importance. Everyone had stopped talking and was looking towards them. A dark, slender girl in a wine-coloured evening frock came through. She paused for a minute, then walked deliberately across the terrace and sat down at an empty table. There was nothing flaunting, nothing out of the way about her demeanour, and yet it had somehow the studied effect of a stage entrance.
Well,
said Mrs. Otterborn. She tossed her turbaned head. She seems to think she's somebody, that girl. Poirot didn't answer. He was watching. The girl had sat down in a place where she could look deliberately across at Lynette Doyle. Presently, Poirot noticed, Lynette Doyle leant forward and said something, and a moment later got up and changed her seat. She was now sitting facing in the opposite direction. Poirot nodded thoughtfully to himself. It was about 5 minutes later that the other girl changed her seat to the opposite side of the terrace. She sat smoking and smiling quietly, the picture of contented ease. But always, as though unconsciously, her meditative gaze was on Simon Doyle's wife. After a quarter of an hour, Lynette Doyle got up abruptly and went into the hotel. Her husband followed her almost immediately. Jacqueline de Belfort smiled and twisted her chair round. She lit a cigarette and stared out over the Nile. She went on smiling to herself. Chapter 4
Monsieur Poirot?
Poirot got hastily to his feet. He had remained sitting out on the terrace alone after everyone else had left. Lost in meditation, he had been staring at the smooth, shiny black rocks when the sound of his name recalled him to himself. It was a well-bred, assured voice, a charming voice, although perhaps a trifle arrogant. Hercule Poirot, rising quickly, looked into the commanding eyes of Lynette Doyle. She wore a wrap of rich purple velvet over her white satin gown, and she looked more lovely and more regal than Poirot had imagined possible.
"You are Monsieur Hercule Poirot?"
said Lynette. It was hardly a question.
"At your service, madame."
"You know who I am, perhaps?"
"Yes, madame. I have heard your name. I know exactly who you are."
Lynette nodded. That was only what she had expected. She went on in her charming, autocratic manner.
"Will you come with me into the card room, Monsieur Poirot? I'm very anxious to speak to you."
"Certainly, madame."
She led the way into the hotel. He followed. She led him into the deserted card room and motioned him to close the door. Then she sank down on a chair at one of the tables, and he sat down opposite her. She plunged straight away into what she wanted to say. There were no hesitations. Her speech came flowingly.
"I've heard a great deal about you, Monsieur Poirot, and I know that you are a very clever man. It happens that I am urgently in need of someone to help me, and I think very possibly that you are the man who could do it."
Poirot inclined his head.
You are very amiable, madame, but you see I am on holiday, and when I am on holiday, I do not take cases.
That could be arranged. It was not offensively said, only with the quiet confidence of a young woman who had always been able to arrange matters to her satisfaction. Lynette Doyle went on. I am the subject, Monsieur Poirot, of an intolerable persecution. That persecution has got to stop. My own idea was to go to the police about it, but my husband seems to think that the police would be powerless to do anything.
Perhaps if you would explain a little further,
murmured Poirot politely. Oh, yes, sir, I will do so. The matter is perfectly simple. There was still no hesitation, no faltering. Lynette Doyle had a clear-cut, business-like mind. She only paused a minute so as to present the facts as concisely as possible. Before I met my husband, he was engaged to a Miss de Belfort. She was also a friend of mine. My husband broke off his engagement to her. They were not suited in any way. She, I am sorry to say, took it rather hard. I am very sorry about that, but these things cannot be helped. She made certain, well, threats, to which I paid very little attention, and which I must say she has not attempted to carry out. But instead, she has adopted the extraordinary course of following us about wherever we go. Poirot raised his eyebrows.
Rather an unusual? Revenge?
Very unusual, and very ridiculous, but also annoying. She bit her lip. Poirot nodded.
Oh, yes, I can imagine that. You are, I understand, on your honeymoon?
Yes. It happened, the first time, at Venice. She was there, at Daniele's. I thought it was just coincidence, rather embarrassing, but that was all. Then we found her on board the boat at Brindisi. We understood that she was going on to Palestine. We left her, as we thought, on the boat. But when we got to Mina House, she was there, waiting for us. Poirot nodded. And now? We came up the Nile by boat. I was half expecting to find her on board. And when she wasn't there, I thought she had stopped being so childish. But when we got here, she was here, waiting. Poirot eyed her keenly for a moment. She was still perfectly composed, but the knuckles of the hand that was gripping the table were white with the force of her grip. He said,
And you are afraid this state of things may continue?
Yes. She paused. Of course, the whole thing is idiotic. Jacqueline is making herself utterly ridiculous. I'm surprised she hasn't got more pride, more dignity. Poirot made a slight gesture.
There are times, madame, when pride and dignity, they go by the board. There are other, stronger emotions.
Oh, yes, possibly, Lynette spoke impatiently. But what on earth can she hope to gain by all this?
It is not always a question of gain, madame.
Something in his tone struck Lynette disagreeably. She flushed, and she said quickly,
No, you're right.
A discussion of motives is beside the point. The crux of the matter is that this has got to be stopped.
And how do you propose that that should be accomplished, madame?
Poirot asked. Well, naturally, my husband and I cannot continue being subjected to this annoyance. There must be some kind of legal redress against such a thing. She spoke impatiently. Poirot looked at her thoughtfully as he asked,
Has she threatened you in actual words in public, used insulting language, attempted any bodily harm?
No.
Then, frankly, madame, I do not see what you can do. If it is a young lady's pleasure to travel in certain places, and those places are the same, where you and your husband find yourself, eh bien, what of it? The air is free to all. There is no question of her forcing herself upon your privacy. It is always in public that these encounters take place.
You mean there is nothing that I can do about it? Lynette sounded incredulous. Poirot said placidly,
Nothing at all as far as I can see. Mademoiselle de Belfort is within her rights.
But it's maddening. It is intolerable that I should have to put up with this.
Poirot said dryly, I sympathize with you, madame, especially as I imagine that you have not often had to put up with things.
Lynette was frowning. There must be some way of stopping it, she murmured. Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
You can always leave. Move on somewhere else, he suggested.
But then she will follow.
Very possibly, yes.
It's absurd.
Precisely.
Anyway, why should we run away? As though...
She stopped.
Exactly, madame. As though. It is all there, is it not?
Lynette lifted her head and stared at him.
What do you mean?
Poirot altered his tone. He leant forward. His voice was confidential, appealing. He said very gently,
Why do you mind so much, madame?
Why? But it's maddening, irritating to the last degree. I've told you why.
Poirot shook his head.
Not altogether.
Lynette said again,
What do you mean?
Poirot leant back, folded his arms, and spoke in a detached, impersonal manner.
Écoutez, madame, I will recount to you a little history. It is that one day, a month or two ago, I am dining in a restaurant in London. At the table next to me are two people, a man and a girl. They are very happy, so it seems, very much in love. They talk with confidence of the future. It is not that I listen to what is not meant for me. They are quite oblivious of who hears them and who does not. The man's back is to me, but I can watch the girl's face. It is very intense. She is in love, heart, soul, and body, and she is not of those who love lightly and often. With her it is clearly the life and the death. They are engaged to be married, these two, that is what I gather, and they talk of where they shall pass the days of their honeymoon. They plan to go to Egypt.
He paused. Lynette said sharply,
Well?
Poirot went on.
That is a month or two ago. By the girl's face, I do not forget it. I know that I shall remember her if I see it again. And I remember, too, the man's voice. And I think you can guess, madame, when it is I see the one and hear the other again. It is here in Egypt. The man is on his honeymoon, yes, but he is on his honeymoon with another woman.
Lynette said sharply,
What of it? I've already mentioned the facts.
The facts? Yes.
Well, then?
Poirot said slowly.
The girl in the restaurant mentioned the friend. A friend whom she was very positive would not let her down. That friend, I think, was you, madame.
Lynette flushed.
Yes. I told you we'd been friends.
And she trusted you?
Yes.
She hesitated for a moment, biting her lip impatiently. Then, as Poirot did not seem disposed to speak, she broke out.
Of course, the whole thing was very unfortunate, but look, these things happen, Monsieur Poirot.
Ah, yes, they happen, madame.
He paused.
You are of the Church of England, I presume?
Yes.
Lynette looked slightly bewildered.
Then you have heard portions of the Bible read aloud in church? You have heard of King David, and of the rich man who had many flocks and herds, and the poor man who had one ewe lamb? And of how the rich man took the poor man's one ewe lamb?
That was something that happened, madame.
Lynette sat up. Her eyes flashed angrily.
I see perfectly what you're driving at, Monsieur Poirot. You think, to put it vulgarly, that I stole my friend's young man. Well, looking at the matter sentimentally, which is, I suppose, the way people of your generation cannot help looking at things, that is possibly true. But the real hard truth is different. I don't deny that Jackie was passionately in love with Simon, but I don't think you take into account that he may not have been equally devoted to her. He was very fond of her, but I think that even before he met me, he was beginning to feel that he had made a mistake. Look at it clearly, Monsieur Poirot. Simon discovers that it is I he loves, not Jackie. What's he to do? Be heroically noble and marry a woman he doesn't care for, and therefore probably ruin three lives? For it is doubtful whether he could make Jackie happy under these circumstances. If he were actually married to her, when he met me, I agree that it might be his duty to stick to her, though I'm not really sure of that. If one person is unhappy, the other suffers too. But an engagement is not really binding. If a mistake has been made, then surely it's better to face the fact before it's too late. I admit that it was very hard on Jackie, and I'm terribly sorry about it, but there it is. It was inevitable.
I wonder.
She stared at him.
What do you mean?
Well, it is very sensible, very logical, all that you say, but it does not explain one thing.
Well, what is that?
Your own attitude, madame. See, this pursuit of you might take it in two ways. It might cause you annoyance, yes, or it might stir your pity that your friend should have been so deeply hurt as to throw all regard for the conventions aside. But that is not the way you react.
No.
To you, this persecution is intolerable. And why? It can be for one reason only, that you feel a sense of guilt.
Lynette sprang to her feet.
How dare you? Really, Monsieur Poirot, this is going too far.
But I do dare, madame. I am going to speak to you quite frankly. I suggest to you that although you may have endeavored to gloss over the fact yourself, you deliberately set about taking your husband from your friend. I suggest that you felt strongly attracted to him at once. But I suggest that there was a moment when you hesitated, when you realized that there was a choice, that you could refrain or go on. I suggest that the initiative rested with you, not with Monsieur Doyle. You are beautiful, madame. You are rich. You are clever, intelligent, and you have charm. You could have exercised that charm, or you could have restrained it. You had everything, madame, that life can offer. Your friend's life was bound up in one person. You knew that. But though you hesitated, you did not hold your hand. You stretched it out. And like the rich man in the Bible, you took the poor man's one ewe lamb.
There was a silence. Lynette controlled herself with an effort and said in a cold voice,
"All this is quite beside the point."
"No, it is not beside the point. I am explaining to you just why the unexpected appearances of Mademoiselle de Belfort have upset you so much. It is because that though she may be unwomanly and undignified in what she is doing, you have the inner conviction that she has right on her side."
"That's not true."
Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
"Well, you refuse to be honest with yourself."
"Not at all."
Poirot said gently,
"I should say, madame, that you have had a happy life, that you have been generous and kindly in your attitude towards others."
"I've tried to be," said Lynette.
The impatient anger died out of her face. She spoke simply, almost forlornly.
"And that is why the feeling that you have deliberately caused injury to someone upsets you so much, and why you are so reluctant to admit the fact. Pardon me if I have been impertinent, but the psychology, it is the most important factor in a case."
Lynette said slowly,
"And even supposing what you say were true, and I don't admit it, mind, what can be done about it now? One can't alter the past. One must deal with things as they are."
Poirot nodded.
"You have the clear brain. Yes, one cannot go back over the past. One must accept things as they are. And sometimes, madame, that is all one can do. Accept the consequences of one's past deeds."
"You mean," said Lynette incredulously, "that I can do nothing? Nothing?"
"You must have courage, madame. That is what it seems like to me."
Lynette said slowly,
"Couldn't you talk to Jackie, to Miss de Belfort? Reason with her?"
"Yes, I could do that." "I will do that if you would like me to do so. But do not expect much result. I fancy that Mademoiselle de Belfort is so much in the grip of a fixed idea that nothing will turn her from it."
"But surely we can do something to extricate ourselves."
"You could, of course, return to England and establish yourself in your own house."
"But even then, I suppose Jacqueline is capable of planting herself in the village so that I should see her every time I went out of the grounds."
"True."
"Besides," said Lynette slowly, "I don't think that Simon would agree to run away."
"What is his attitude in this?"
"Oh, he's furious, simply furious."
Poirot nodded thoughtfully. Lynette said appealingly,
"You will talk to her?"
"Yes, I will do that. But it is my opinion that I shall not be able to accomplish anything."
Lynette said violently,
"Jackie is extraordinary. One can't tell what she will do."
"You spoke just now of certain threats she had made. Would you tell me what those threats were?"
Lynette shrugged her shoulders.
"She threatened to, well, kill us both. Jackie can be rather Latin sometimes."
"I see."
Poirot's tone was grave.
"You will act for me?"
"No, madame."
His tone was firm.
"I will not accept a commission from you. I will do what I can in the interests of humanity, that, yes. There is here a situation that is full of difficulty and danger. I will do what I can to clear it up, but I am not so very sanguine as to my chance of success."
Lynette Doyle said slowly,
But you will not act for me?
Non, madame, said Hercule Poirot.
Chapter 5 Hercule Poirot found Jacqueline de Belfort sitting on the rocks directly overlooking the Nile. He'd felt fairly certain that she had not retired for the night and that he would find her somewhere about the grounds of the hotel. She was sitting with her chin cupped in the palms of her hands, and she didn't turn her head or look round at the sound of his approach.
Mademoiselle de Belfort, said Poirot, you permit that I speak to you for a little moment?
Jacqueline turned her head slightly. A faint smile played round her lips.
Certainly,
she said.
You are Monsieur Hercule Poirot, I think.
Shall I make a guess?
You are acting for Mrs. Doyle, who has promised you a large fee if you succeed in your mission.
Poirot sat down on a bench near her.
Your assumption is partially correct, he said, smiling. I have just come from Mrs. Doyle, but I am not accepting any fee from her. And strictly speaking, I am not acting for her.
Oh.
Jacqueline studied him attentively.
Then why have you come? She asked abruptly.
Hercule Poirot's reply was in the form of another question.
Have you ever seen me before, mademoiselle?
She shook her head.
No, I don't think so.
Yet I have seen you. I sat next to you once at Chez Ma Tante. You were there with Mr. Simon Doyle.
A strange mask-like expression came over the girl's face. She said,
I remember that evening.
Since then, said Poirot, many things have occurred.
Yes, as you say, many things have occurred.
Her voice was hard with an undertone of desperate bitterness.
Mademoiselle, I speak as a friend. Barry, you're dead.
She looked startled.
What do you mean?
Give up the past. Turn to the future. What is done, bitterness will not undo it.
Well, I'm sure that that would suit dear Lynette admirably.
Poirot made a gesture.
I am not thinking of her at this moment. I am thinking of you. You have suffered, yes, but what you are doing now will only prolong that suffering.
She shook her head.
You're wrong. There are times when I almost enjoy myself.
Eh? And that, mademoiselle, is the worst of all.
She looked up swiftly.
You're not stupid, she said.
She added slowly,
I believe you mean to be kind.
Go home, mademoiselle. You are young. You have brains. The world is before you.
Jacqueline shook her head slowly.
You don't understand? Oh, you won't. Simon is my world.
Love is not everything, mademoiselle,
Poirot said gently.
It is only when we are young that we think it is.
But the girl still shook her head.
You don't understand.
She shot him a quick look.
You know all about it, of course. You've talked to Lynette. And you were in the restaurant that night. Simon and I loved each other.
I know that you loved him.
She was quick to perceive the inflection of his words. She repeated with emphasis,
We loved each other. And I loved Lynette. I trusted her. She was my best friend. All her life, Lynette has been able to buy everything she wanted. She's never denied herself anything. When she saw Simon, she wanted him, and she just took him.
And he allowed himself to be bought?
Jacqueline shook her dark head slowly.
No, it's not quite like that. If it were, I shouldn't be here now. You're suggesting that Simon isn't worth caring for. If he'd married Lynette for her money, that would be true, but he didn't marry her for her money. It's more complicated than that. There's such a thing as glamour, Monsieur Poirot, and money helps that. Lynette had an atmosphere, you see. She was the queen of a kingdom, the young princess, luxurious to her fingertips. It was like a stage setting. She had the world at her feet. One of the richest and most sought-after peers in England wanting to marry her. And she stoops instead to the obscure Simon Doyle. Do you wonder it went to his head?
She made a sudden gesture.
Look at the moon up there. You see her very plainly, don't you? She's very real. But if the sun were to shine, you wouldn't be able to see her at all. It was rather like that. I was the moon. When the sun came out, Simon couldn't see me anymore. He was dazzled.
He couldn't see anything but the sun. Lynette.
She paused and then went on.
So you see, it was glamour. She went to his head.
And then there's her complete assurance, her habit of command. She's so sure of herself that she makes other people sure. Simon was weak, perhaps, but then he's only a very simple person. He would have loved me and me only if Lynette hadn't come along and snatched him up in her golden chariot. And I know perfectly that he wouldn't have ever fallen in love with her if she hadn't made him.
That is what you think, yes.
I know it. He loved me. He will always love me,
Poirot said.
Even now?
A quick answer seemed to rise to her lips, then be stifled. She looked at Poirot, and a deep, burning colour spread over her face. She looked away, her head dropped down. She said in a low, stifled voice,
Yes, I know. He hates me now. Yes, hates me.
He'd better be careful. With a quick gesture, she fumbled in a little silk bag that lay on the seat. Then she held out her hand. On the palm of it was a small, pearl-handled pistol. A dainty toy, it looked.
Nice little thing, isn't it? She said. Looks too foolish to be real, but it is real. One of those bullets would kill a man or a woman, and I'm a good shot.
She smiled a faraway, reminiscent smile.
When I went home as a child with my mother to South Carolina, my grandfather taught me to shoot. He was the old-fashioned kind that believes in shooting, especially where honour is concerned. My father, too, he fought several duels as a young man. He was a good swordsman. He killed a man once. That was over a woman. So you see, Monsieur Poirot,
she met his eyes squarely,
I have hot blood in me.
I bought this when it first happened.
I meant to kill one or other of them. The trouble was I couldn't decide which. Both of them would have been unsatisfactory. If I'd thought Lynette would have looked afraid, but she's got plenty of physical courage. She can stand up to physical action. And then I thought I'd wait. That appealed to me more and more. After all, I could do it any time. It would be more fun to wait and think about it. And when this idea came to my mind, to follow them, whenever they arrived at some faraway spot and were together and happy, they should see me. And it worked. It got Lynette badly. In a way, nothing else could have done. It got right under her skin. That was when I began to enjoy myself. And there's nothing she can do about it. I'm always perfectly pleasant and polite. There's not a word they can take hold of. It's poisoning everything, everything for them.
Her voice rang out, clear and silvery. Poirot grasped her arm.
Be quiet. Quiet, I tell you.
Jacqueline looked at him.
Well,
she said. Her smile was definitely challenging.
Mademoiselle, I beseech you, do not do what you are doing.
Leave dear Lynette alone, you mean?
No, it is deeper than that. Do not open your heart to evil.
Her lips fell apart. A look of bewilderment came into her eyes. Poirot went on gravely.
Because if you do, evil will come. Oh, yes, very surely evil will come. It will enter in and make its home within you. And after a little while it will no longer be possible to drive it out.
Jacqueline stared at him. Her glance seemed to waver, to flicker uncertainly. She said,
I don't know.
Then she cried out defiantly,
You can't stop me.
No,
said Hercule Poirot.
I cannot stop you.
His voice was sad.
Even if I were to kill her, you couldn't stop me?
No, not if you are willing to pay the price.
Jacqueline de Belfort laughed.
I'm not afraid of death. What have I got to live for, after all? I suppose you believe it's very wrong to kill a person who has injured you, even if they've taken away everything you had in the world.
Poirot said steadily,
Yes, mademoiselle, I believe it is the unforgivable offence to kill.
Jacqueline laughed again.
Then you ought to approve of my present scheme of revenge, because you see, as long as it works, I shan't use that pistol. Oh, but I'm afraid. Yes, afraid sometimes. It all goes red. I want to hurt her, to stick a knife into her, to put my dear little pistol close against her head, and then just press with my finger. Oh!
The exclamation startled him.
"What is it, mademoiselle?"
She turned her head and was staring into the shadows. Someone standing over there. He's gone now. Poirot looked round sharply. The place seemed quite deserted.
There seems no one here but ourselves, mademoiselle. He got up. In any case, I have said all I came to say. I wish you good night.
Jacqueline got up too. She said almost pleadingly,
You do understand that I can't do what you asked me to do?
Poirot shook his head.
No, for you could do it. There is always a moment. Your friend Lynette, there was a moment too in which she could have held her hand. She let it pass by, and if one does that, then one is committed to the enterprise and there comes no second chance.
No second chance,
said Jacqueline de Belfort. She stood brooding for a moment, then she lifted her head defiantly. Good night, Monsieur Poirot. He shook his head sadly and followed her up the path to the hotel. Chapter 6 On the following morning, Simon Doyle joined Hercule Poirot as the latter was leaving the hotel to walk down to the town. Good morning, Monsieur Poirot.
Ah, good morning, Monsieur Doyle.
You going into town? Mind if I stroll along with you?
But certainly I shall be delighted.
The two men walked side by side, passed out through the gateway and turned into the cool shade of the gardens. Then Simon removed his pipe from his mouth and said, I understand, Monsieur Poirot, that my wife had a talk with you last night.
That is so.
Simon Doyle was frowning a little. He belonged to that type of men of action who find it difficult to put thoughts into words and who have trouble in expressing themselves clearly. I'm glad of one thing, he said. You've made her realize that we're more or less powerless in the matter.
Well, there is clearly no legal redress, agreed Poirot.
Exactly. Lynette didn't seem to understand that. He gave a faint smile. Lynette's been brought up to believe that every annoyance can automatically be referred to the police.
It would be pleasant if such were the case, said Poirot.
There was a pause. Then Simon said suddenly, his face going very red as he spoke, It's infamous that she should be victimized like this. She's done nothing. If anyone likes to say I behaved like a cad, they're welcome to say so. I suppose I did. But I won't have the whole thing visited on Lynette. She had nothing whatever to do with it. Poirot bowed his head gravely, but said nothing. Did you, have you talked to Jackie, Miss de Belfort?
Yes, I have spoken with her.
Did you get her to see sense?
I am afraid not.
Simon broke out irritably. Can't she see what an ass she's making of herself? Doesn't she realize that no decent woman would behave as she is doing? Hadn't she got any pride or self-respect? Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
She has only a sense of injury, shall we say, he replied.
Yes, but damn it all, man, decent girls don't behave like this. I admit I was entirely to blame. I treated her damn badly and all that. I should quite understand her being thoroughly fed up with me and never wishing to see me again. But this following me round, it's indecent. Making a show of herself. What the devil does she hope to get out of it?
Perhaps revenge?
Idiotic. I'd really understand better if she tried to do something melodramatic, like taking a pot shot at me.
You think that would be more like her, yes?
Well, frankly, I do. She's hot-blooded and she's got an ungovernable temper. I shouldn't be surprised at her doing anything while she was in a white-hot rage. But this spying business, oh. He shook his head.
It is more subtle, yes. It is intelligent.
Doyle stared at him. You don't understand. It's playing hell with Lynette's nerves.
And yours?
Simon looked at him with momentary surprise.
Me?
I'd like to wring the little devil's neck.
There is nothing, then, of the old feeling left?
My dear Monsieur Poirot, how can I put it? It's like the moon when the sun comes out. You don't know it's there any more. When once I'd met Lynette, Jackie didn't exist.
Tiens, c'est drôle ça,
muttered Poirot. I beg your pardon?
Your simile interested me, that is all.
Again, flushing, Simon said, I suppose Jackie told you that I'd only married Lynette for her money. Well, that's a damn lie. I wouldn't marry any woman for money. What Jackie doesn't understand is that it's difficult for a fellow when a woman cares for him as she cared for me.
Ah?
Poirot looked up sharply. Simon blundered on.
It sounds a caddish thing to say, but Jackie was too fond of me.
Un qui aime et un qui se laisse aimer,
murmured Poirot.
Eh, what do you say? But you see, a man doesn't want to feel that a woman cares more for him than he does for her.
His voice grew warm as he went on. He doesn't want to feel owned, body and soul. It's that damned possessive attitude. You know, this man is mine, he belongs to me. That's the sort of thing I can't stick. No man could stick. He wants to get away, to get free. He wants to own his woman. He doesn't want her to own him. He broke off, and with fingers that trembled slightly, he lit a cigarette. Poirot said,
And it is like that that you felt with Mademoiselle Jacqueline?
Eh?
Simon stared and then admitted, Yes. Well, yes, as a matter of fact, I did. She doesn't realize that, of course, and it's not the sort of thing I could ever tell her. But I was feeling restless. And then I met Lynette, and she just swept me off my feet. I'd never seen anything so lovely. It was all so amazing. Everyone kowtowing to her, and then her singling out a poor chump like me. His tone held boyish awe and astonishment.
I see,
said Poirot. He nodded thoughtfully.
Yes, I see.
Well, why can't Jackie take it like a man? Demanded Simon resentfully.
A very faint smile twitched Poirot's upper lip.
Well, you see, Monsieur Doyle, to begin with, she is not a man.
No. But I meant, take it like a good sport. After all, you've got to take your medicine when it comes to you. The fault's all mine, I admit, but there it is. If you no longer care for a girl, it's simply madness to marry her. And now I see what Jackie's really like and the length she is likely to go to, I feel I've had rather a lucky escape.
The length she is likely to go to,
Poirot repeated thoughtfully.
Have you any idea, Monsieur Doyle, what those lengths are?
Simon looked at him, rather startled.
No. At least, what do you mean?
You know she carries a pistol about with her?
Simon frowned, then shook his head.
Well, I don't believe she'll use that now. She might have done earlier on, but I believe it's got past that. No, she's just spiteful now, trying to take it out of us both.
Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
It may be so,
he said doubtfully.
No, it's Lynette I'm worrying about, said Simon, somewhat unnecessarily.
I quite realize that, said Poirot.
I'm not really afraid of Jackie doing anything melodramatic, you know, that shooting stuff, but this spying and following business has absolutely got Lynette on the raw. I'll tell you the plan I've made, and perhaps you can suggest improvements on it. Or, to begin with, I've announced fairly openly that we're going to stay here 10 days. But tomorrow, the steamer Karnak starts from Shellal to Wadi Halfa. I propose to book passages on that under an assumed name. Tomorrow we'll go on an excursion to Philae. Lynette's maid can take the luggage. We'll join the Karnak at Shellal. When Jackie finds we don't come back, it'll be too late. We shall be well on our way. She'll assume we have given her the slip and gone back to Cairo. In fact, I might even bribe the porter to say so. Inquiry at the tourist offices won't help her because our names won't appear. How does that strike you?
Well, it is well imagined, yes.
And suppose she waits here till you return? Well, we may not return. We could go on to Khartoum and then perhaps by air to Kenya. She can't follow us all over the globe.
No, there must come a time when financial reasons forbid. She has very little money, I understand.
Simon looked at him with admiration.
That's clever of you. Do you know I hadn't thought of that? Jackie's as poor as they make 'em.
And yet she has managed to follow you so far?
Simon said doubtfully. Well, she's got a small income, of course. Something under 200 a year, I imagine.
I suppose she must have sold out the capital to do what she's doing.
So the time will come when she has exhausted her resources and is quite penniless.
Yes.
Simon wriggled uneasily. The thought seemed to make him uncomfortable. Poirot watched him attentively.
No, he remarked. No, it is not a pretty thought.
Simon said rather angrily, Well, I can't help it. Then he added, What do you think of my plan?
I think it may work, yes, but it is, of course, a retreat.
Simon flushed.
Well, you mean we're running away? Yes, that's true. But Lynette?
Poirot watched him, then gave a short nod.
As you say, it may be the best way, but remember, Mademoiselle de Belfort has brains.
Simon said somberly,
Some day I feel we've got to make a stand and fight it out. Her attitude isn't reasonable.
Reasonable? Mon Dieu!
Cried Poirot.
There's no reason why women shouldn't behave like rational beings, asserted Simon stolidly.
Poirot said dryly, Quite frequently they do. That is even more upsetting, he added. I, too, shall be on a Karnak. It is part of my itinerary.
Oh, Simon hesitated, then said, choosing his words with some embarrassment, That isn't on our account in any way. I mean, I wouldn't like to think...
Poirot disabused him quickly. Not at all. It was all arranged before I left London. I always make my plans well in advance.
Well, you don't just move on from place to place as the fancy takes you. Isn't the latter really pleasanter?
Perhaps. But to succeed in life, every detail should be arranged well beforehand.
Simon laughed and said, That is how the more skilful murderer behaves, I suppose.
Yes, though I must admit that the most brilliant crime I remember, and one of the most difficult to solve, was committed on the spur of the moment.
Simon said boyishly, You must tell us something about your cases on board the Karnak.
No. That would be to talk, what do you call it, the shop.
Oh, yes, but your kind of shop is rather thrilling. Mrs. Allerton thinks so. She's longing to get a chance to cross-question you.
Mrs. Allerton? Oh, that is the charming grey-haired woman who has such a devoted son.
Yes, she'll be on the Karnak, too.
Does she know that you...
Certainly not, said Simon with emphasis. Nobody knows. I've gone on the principle that it's better not to trust anybody.
An admirable sentiment, and one which I always adopt. By the way, the third member of your party, the tall, grey-haired man...
Pennington?
Yes. He is travelling with you?
Simon said grimly. Not very usual on a honeymoon, you were thinking. Well, Pennington is Lynette's American trustee. We ran across him by chance in Cairo.
Ah, vraiment. You permit a question? She is of age, madame your wife?
Simon looked amused. Well, she isn't actually 21 yet, but she hadn't got to ask anyone's consent before marrying me. It was the greatest surprise to Pennington. He left New York on the Carmenic, 2 days before Lynette's letter got there telling him of our marriage, so he knew nothing about it.
The Carmenic?
Murmured Poirot. It was the greatest surprise to him when we ran into him at Shepherd's in Cairo.
Oh, that was indeed a coincidence.
Yes, and we found that he was coming on this Nile trip, so naturally we foregathered. Well, couldn't have done anything else decently. Besides that, it's been, a relief in some ways. He looked embarrassed again. You see, Lynette's been all strung up, expecting Jackie to turn up anywhere and everywhere. While we were alone together, the subject kept coming up. Andrew Pennington's a help that way. We have to talk of outside matters.
Your wife has not confided in Mr. Pennington?
No. Simon's jaw looked aggressive. It's nothing to do with anyone else. Besides, when we started on this Nile trip, we thought we'd seen the end of the business. Poirot shook his head.
You have not seen the end of it yet. No. The end is not yet at hand. I am very sure of that.
I must say, Monsieur Poirot, you're not very encouraging. Poirot looked at him with a slight feeling of irritation. He thought to himself,
The Anglo-Saxon. He takes nothing seriously but playing games. He does not grow up.
Lynette Doyle, Jacqueline de Belfort. Both of them took the business seriously enough. But in Simon's attitude, he could find nothing but male impatience and annoyance. He said,
You will permit me an impertinent question? Was it your idea to come to Egypt for your honeymoon?
Simon flushed. No. No, of course not. As a matter of fact, I'd rather have gone anywhere else. But Lynette was absolutely set upon it, and so... He stopped rather lamely.
Naturally,
said Poirot gravely. He appreciated the fact that if Lynette Doyle was set upon anything, that thing had to happen. He thought to himself,
I have now heard three separate accounts of the affair. Lynette Doyle's, Jacqueline de Belfort, and Simon Doyle's. Which of them is nearest to the truth?
Chapter 7 Simon and Lynette Doyle set off on their expedition to Philae about 11 o'clock the following morning. Jacqueline de Belfort, sitting on the hotel balcony, watched them set off in the picturesque sailing boat. What she did not see was the departure of a car from the front door of the hotel, laden with luggage and in which sat a demure-looking maid, and which turned to the right in the direction of Shellal. Hercule Poirot decided to pass the remaining 2 hours before lunch on the island of Elephantine, immediately opposite the hotel. He went down to the landing stage. There were two men just stepping into one of the hotel boats, and Poirot joined them. The men were obviously strangers to each other.
The younger of them had arrived by train the day before. He was a tall, dark-haired young man, with a thin face and a pugnacious chin. He was wearing an extremely dirty pair of grey flannel trousers and a high-necked polo jumper singularly unsuited to the climate. The other was a slightly podgy, middle-aged man who lost no time in entering into conversation with Poirot in idiomatic but slightly broken English. Far from taking part in the conversation, the younger man merely scowled at them both and then deliberately turned his back on them and proceeded to admire the agility with which the Nubian boatman steered the boat with his toes as he manipulated the sail with his hands. It was very peaceful on the water, the great smooth, slippery black rocks gliding by and the soft breeze fanning their faces. Elephantine was reached very quickly, and on going ashore, Poirot and his loquacious acquaintance made straight for the museum. By this time, the latter had produced a card, which he handed to Poirot with a little bow. It bore the inscription, Signor Guido Ricchetti, Archeologo. Not to be outdone, Poirot returned the bow and extracted his own card. These formalities completed, the two men stepped into the museum together, the Italian pouring forth a stream of erudite information. They were by now conversing in French. The young man in the flannel trousers strolled listlessly round the museum, yawning from time to time, and then escaped to the outer air. Poirot and Signor Ricchetti at last followed him. The Italian was energetic in examining the ruins, but presently Poirot, espying a green-lined sunshade which he recognised on the rocks down by the river, escaped in that direction. Mrs. Allerton was sitting on a large rock, a sketchbook by her side and a book on her lap. Poirot removed his hat politely, and Mrs. Allerton at once entered into conversation. "Good morning," she said. "I suppose it would be quite impossible to get rid of some of these awful children." A group of small black figures surrounded her, all grinning and posturing and holding out imploring hands as they lisped, "Bexies!" at intervals, hopefully. "I thought they'd get tired of me," said Mrs. Allerton sadly. "They've been watching me for over 2 hours now, and they close in on me little by little, and then I yell, "Imshi!" and brandish my sunshade at them, and they scatter for a minute or two, and then they come back and stare and stare, and their eyes are simply disgusting, and so are their noses. And I don't believe I really like children, not unless they're more or less washed and have the rudiments of manners." She laughed ruefully. Poirot gallantly attempted to disperse the mob for her, but without avail. They scattered and then reappeared, closing in once more. "If there were only any peace in Egypt, I should like it better," said Mrs. Allerton. "But you can never be alone anywhere. Someone is always pestering you for money or offering you donkeys or beads or expeditions to native villages or duck shooting."
"It is a great disadvantage, that is true," agreed Poirot.
He spread his handkerchief cautiously on the rock and sat down gingerly upon it.
"Your son is not with you this morning?" he went on.
"No. Tim had some letters to get off before we leave. We're doing the trip to the Second Cataract, you know."
"I too."
"Oh, I'm so glad. I want to tell you that I'm quite thrilled to meet you. When we were in Mallorca, there was a Mrs. Leach there, and she was telling us the most wonderful things about you. She had lost a ruby ring, bathing, and she was just lamenting that you weren't there to find it for her."
"Ah, parbleu! But I am not a diving seal."
They both laughed. Mrs. Allerton went on. "I saw you from my window walking down the drive with Simon Doyle this morning. Oh, do tell me what you make of him. We're all so excited about him."
"Ah, truly?"
"Yes. You know, his marriage to Lynette Ridgway was the greatest surprise. She was supposed to be going to marry Lord Windlesham, and then suddenly she gets engaged to this man no one had ever heard of."
"You know her well, madame?"
"No, but a cousin of mine, Joanna Southwood, is one of her best friends."
"Ah, yes. I have read that name in the papers."
He was silent a moment or two, and then went on.
"She is a young lady very much in the news, Mademoiselle Joanna Southwood."
"Oh, she knows how to advertise herself all right," snapped Mrs. Allerton.
"You do not like her, madame?"
"Oh, that was a nasty remark of mine." Mrs. Allerton looked penitent.
"You see, I'm old-fashioned.
I don't like her much. Tim and she are the greatest friends, though."
"I see," said Poirot.
His companion shot a quick look at him. She changed the subject. "How very few young people there are out here. That pretty girl with the chestnut hair and the appalling mother in the turban is almost the only young creature in the place. You've talked to her a great deal, I notice. She interests me, that child."
"Why is that, madame?"
"I feel sorry for her. You can suffer so much when you're young and sensitive.
I think she is suffering. Yes, she is not happy, poor little one.
Tim and I call her the sulky girl. I've tried to talk to her once or twice, but she's snubbed me on each occasion.